Welcome to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, a show dedicated to the artistry and science of sports field management and celebrating the groundskeepers who create those masterpieces. The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 68 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. And welcome, everybody, to another year, fun-filled year, may I say, of tomfoolery and science and information on the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. I'm Paul Sawaska, your host in a new year. This is going to be the big one for Diamond Da Vinci. We're going to pass the number. We're going to pass five listeners, I think.
I think we're going to get to seven, Paul.
Oh, come on, that's putting
including
pressure.
Including my mother-in-law.
Of course, the lovely voice you're listening to is Teresa Beyer, my talented co-host. Teresa, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year's, Paul.
I'm assuming you had great holidays.
Yeah, we weren't sick, so that was
nice. I was.
I mean, we were, but we weren't as sick as we were before, so that's good. You so, were. That's no fun. Yeah.
It's all right. It was between shows, so I was all right.
It worked out.
Yes. So do you have any New Year's resolutions? You follow that path?
Well, not really resolutions. I like goals. Mm-hmm. And so my goal is to improve some time management skills. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, balancing little ones along with the job.
Yeah, well, that'll double trouble this very shortly with the second one. We'll see how that works out.
Yeah, I'm not counting any of my efforts until at least May.
I'm going to be interested to see if we can get all of our podcasts off on time in the next several months.
Me too.
Well, you know, I do have a resolution too, and I've thought long and hard about this, with all the consternation and everything else that comes with it, I have decided that I'm going to really work hard at
growing hair,
liking your science segments. It's going to be a tough one, and you have no idea what this is going to put me through. I'm going to try like hell to get excited about your science segments on the show. And that is my big New Year's resolution. And I want all of you listeners to hold me to it because, you know, how I can tend to fall asleep. Science, yes.
Look, we can't all be brilliant. it's okay.
Well, you know, I do want to say, you know, I want to let's move along here because yeah. I want to get on some of the subject at hand. But hold me to that resolution time we talk a science segment. I tend to doze off or whatever I do. but you know, I watched obviously during the holiday break. I was watching a lot of football as everybody else was, and you know, the one thing that's been amazing to me is how the El Nino has affected football fields in the north. And, you know, I was watching of course, in Packerland, and I was watching a recent Bears game. And, you know, those two areas are areas that see some of the fiercest cold.
Oh, yeah.
In the early part of the winter, more so than some portions of the east because
they
the
get
east
a lot more wind.
Yeah, and they just get the deep cold from the prairies of Canada.
The deep cold,
We haven't had it. And so, you know, I'm watching games in early January where, you know, Lambeau and Soldier Field are immaculate. I mean, Lambeau had a beautiful pattern on it. It looked like it was mid-September there, with the exception of people bundled up. The field looked fabulous, holding really well. Same thing with the Bears game. In fact, the Bears field, it doesn't even look like they've ever sodded this summer or this fall. And, you know, so it really is an amazing thing to see for these football
that's a really good point.
And soccer groundskeepers throughout the northern half of the country who have been probably singing the praise of the super El Nino that we're having this year, thinking, you know, this isn't too bad. Throw a little ryegrass down and we're put blankets on and we're still looking like we're mid-September and the footing's been great. So I think a lot of those guys have probably said amen to the super El Nino this year.
Well, actually, if any of our listeners are in that position, I'd love to hear from them and find out, because I also wonder if it's not a little bit more stressful because you're out of your normal routine.
Yeah, well, exactly. Because normally by this time, your field is pretty much set. Screw this, I'm out of it.
Yeah, you know, and our grass didn't go dormant up here this winter.
Paint me if you want, but that's not the case. They've all been they've just been immaculate. I've been blown away. I'm blown away.
So I like George Costanza. Serenity now.
Are you blown? Are you blown?
Blown away, George.
But as we all know, the football season sadly has to come to an end, and we're in the midst of playoff season right now, and coming up is the Super Bowl, and we've got a great guest coming up on the flip side here of the commercial break. So stick with us. We've got a fantastic, pretty much hour-long love fest of the Super Bowl coming up right after this. Happy New Year from Beacon Athletics. And with the new year comes our new 2016 catalog, chocked full of product for you sports field groundskeepers to maintain your athletic fields. If you don't have or never have received a Beacon catalog, simply give us a call at Beacon Athletics at 800-747-5985, and we'll rush one right out to you. You can also request a catalog from www.beaconathletics.com. Our web store has all of our products from the catalog and more. Plus, it's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, ready and willing to take your orders. Start preparing for the 2016 season by shopping with us today. And our special guest today is one that really needs no introduction. He's been in the industry as long as I think there's been dirt on the ground. George Toma, a longtime friend of mine, and obviously to everyone in this industry, we all know George, and he's got a wealth of knowledge of history. And when it comes to the Super Bowl, he is the man. George, welcome this morning.
Well, good morning, Paul. It's always good to hear your voice. I always go back with you and Harry Gill, you know, and two great people.
Way, way back. George, you know, you started out in baseball, and somehow your trip through time and turf brought you to football. Can you explain to our listeners how you got involved with the NFL?
Well, actually, I worked for the Kansas City Athletics at that time. I'm a coal miner from Pennsylvania, and I took over Municipal Stadium in 1957. I was with Charleston, West Virginia, a Detroit Tiger farm club, and I had the job offered to me in Kansas City. So first thing I did was called up Emil Bossert, my mentor, and he told me, stay out of Kansas City. He said, don't go there. He said, I've been in there a couple times a month for Lou Boudreau, who was managing there. And he says, stay out there in the summertime. In the springtime, it'll flood you out. In the summertime, it'll bake you out. So I went out, you know, to look at the job, and it was bad. I mean, it was nothing but crowfoot and knotweed. And so I went back to Charleston, West Virginia, and I also went out to Denver. Denver offered me a job, and I went back to Charleston, West Virginia, and I thought it over. I said, George, take that Kansas City job. If you mess it up, nobody would ever know it's so bad. So we had baseball. And then in 1963, football came into Kansas City. In my days, in working in Kansas City, they were a major league ball club in 1955 when they became major league. But we always had a minor league budget.
Mm-hmm.
So I was up on top of the roof in center field. Underneath our shop, there's a hole in the roof where we put the flag up. And I was up there, closing the hole with a piece of plyboard. And I seen a man walking across the grass. And I slid down that flagpole like a fireman and went out there and told the man, hey, it's early in the morning. We have the grass overseeded with rye and for the spring, and you can't be in here. So he walked out nicely, and about an hour later, the mayor of Kansas City came out, and his big Cadillac, he called him the chief, Mayor Orbardo, and he called me over and said, George, I have two men here, and I want you to show them the stadium, the clubhouses, the offices, concessions, everything. So the first man came out, he introduced me as Mr. Jack. He was a big guy. And the second guy came out was the guy that I threw out, told him to leave the stadium, actually threw him out. And they said, this is Mr. Lamar. So about a month later, Mr. Jack was Jack Stedman, the president, to be the president of the Chiefs. And the little guy came out was Lamar Hunt. He was the owner.
Oh, man.
So, then we got along good with Lamar, I did, and so the Kansas City got the Dallas Texans to become the Kansas City Chiefs in 1963 was our first year. And then they were the American Football League, and then we had the National Football League. And then they both joined together, NFL and AFL, and then it was Thanksgiving. A week before Thanksgiving on a Sunday, Pete Rozelle came into Kansas City and they had a press conference, and they asked Pete Rozelle what was the difference between the NFL and the AFL. And he stated that he didn't see much difference in the play of the two teams, but he said he never has seen such a beautiful, outstanding manicured, playable football field. And that hit the nation. And then 9 o'clock that Monday morning, it was all over. And then Tex Schramm, who was the president, general manager of Dallas Texans, called Jack Stedman, president of the Chiefs, and asked to borrow me for a week to go down to the Cotton Bowl and help the crew down there prepare the field for Thursday night football game in color, the Dallas Cowboys playing the Cleveland Browns. So I did that, and then right around January, in the last week in December, Tex Schramm again called Jackson and asked me to borrow me for a while, so to go down and get the field ready for January 1st for the Cotton Bowl game, which was SMU against the Georgia Bulldogs, and that was on January the 1st on a Saturday. Then January the 2nd was a Sunday, and that's when the Dallas Cowboys played the Green Bay Packers, and the Green Bay Packers beat the Cowboys, and then Pete Rozelle invited me to do the first Super Bowl.
Wow. Huh.
But I remember doing that Cotton Bowl game, and we thought, well, you know, we had to work all night. So they asked me, what's the first thing I need? I said, the first thing we'll need is a helicopter. First thing, I want that helicopter to go down the field and blow all the trash into the stands. So then as we paint the end zones and the field, we need a helicopter to dry the field.
Yeah.
But we were painting, and about midnight, the fog comes in, and you can
know
fog, and you know where the paint was wet, and so we kept on painting, and the next morning, the Lord was with us. The sun came out, the helicopter, and then the game was played, and the Packers beat the Cowboys. So then we went out to the Los Angeles Coliseum to do the first Super Bowl.
See, now, knowing that the Packers won, that's how Paul would say that you knew God was on your side.
Yeah,
right. They were on our side, you know. I believe in God. I pray every day for God to give me and the people I work with the strength and the knowledge so we can do a good job at our work.
Well, apparently he must be listening because of the work that you've done over the years. Hey, let me ask you a question. Were you the first one to paint a logo on a football field?
I don't think I was the first one. Lamar Hunt, I remember distinctly Lamar Hunt coming down on the field with a friend of his, Bill McNutt, for the first exhibition game that was played in Municipal Stadium. And they came over and they talked to me how they'd like to have this field painted, you know, with the logos, mm-hmm. you know, and numbers, and have the Chiefs' names in the end zones, you know, and things like that.
Sure.
And in those days, we didn't have those airless sprayers like we had now.
Right.
We had these 2-gallon Hudson sprayers that we painted the end zones with. And
holy cow.
I used to take the 100-gallon sprayer and put the paint in the 100-gallon sprayer and then use a spray miser gun to paint the backgrounds and the white border. So, we painted it up like they wanted it to, and the first logo was a tough one because it was an Indian head. And then Lamar Hunt was responsible for putting the arrows on the field. And he was a good man. And a little quick story that when Bill McNutt and Lamar, they'd come down before the game and after each game and talk to me what they wanted. They were really interested in the playing field.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got my first Super Bowl, Bill McNutt owns the Deluxe Bakery in Corsicana, Texas, a large fruit case, probably the world's largest fruitcake maker. So he says for every Super Bowl that I do, he would send me a Super Bowl, send me a fruitcake, but I would have to give him $1 as a retainer. So poor Bill died in 2007. And to this day now, for 49 years, I get a fruitcake.
Oh, my gosh.
And I've had 49 fruitcakes for $49.
That's a great story. So now, and of course, back then, you know, there were no, I would assume there were really no true turf paints that were made specifically for turf, correct?
Right. I mean, we used latex-based paints at
that time.
And the first Super Bowl, there was only a week before between the games, and I had to come up with a logo for the center of the field. Usually the league comes up with a logo and they tell you what it is. So a friend of mine, Calvin Autry, we got together and we made a logo of a football with a crown on it and NFL and AFL.
Uh-huh.
And we painted, you know, we got paint, and then we were running out of paint for the Super Bowl out there in L.A., so we had to go to get some hockey paint and finish the job with hockey paint. It was late at night, and we only had five people working. It was only myself and four people at the Coliseum. That's all we had.
Wow.
We got it done, you know, and it worked out well. But when I went out there, I had a 3x4 trunk just loaded with strings and nails and Hudson sprayers. And today we have tractor trailers full of equipment.
Wow.
Today.
What a difference.
Oh, wow.
And because we have canvases for, you know, the playing field, the canvases that we cover the practice fields up, and all types of equipment.
Hmm.
And it's a big operation now.
Yeah.
You know, from four people or five people, we have as much as 30 to 35 people on the crew.
Well, tell us a little bit more on the progression of that. So you started out, you know, basically they shipped you out there back in the early days, and it was you and whatever crew came with the location. So, you know, at what point did this become a big event, or at what point in your mind as you went through those years did you start thinking this is getting a lot bigger than I can handle by myself? Was there an aha moment that said, "Holy cow, we got to get more people in here because you're asking me to do more than I can handle."
Actually, going down, we were down at the floor down at Tulane University, and two or three Super Bowls later, and I took one man from our ground crew with Kansas City Athletics, and then they start giving us practice fields to do, and it just kept on going on from there.
Huh.
And then it's so big now, you really don't have much time on the field sometimes because the halftime and pregame shows practice just about every day or at night, so we just take our canvas. We have a canvas that we put on the field, and it has the lines painted on it and everything, and we cover the grass field with that, and even it's artificial, we'll cover it, and they'll practice on it. And sometimes, like on Thursdays and Fridays, are just about lost because they'll practice maybe the whole day, 12 hours, to go through the whole show.
Sure.
So most of our work is, has to be done at night, and after the rehearsals, we have to take brooms, and brushes, and brush up the natural grass. Lift it back up, and a lot of times the rehearsals do a lot of damage. I remember in San Diego at a Super Bowl, they had 40 baby grand pianos on trailers.
Oh,
and
Jesus.
If it rained, it wouldn't work, with the baby grants. I had to stop them because they were rutting the field already. It was late at night. The dew's coming up underneath the field cover, and you just have to stop them. Or down in Tampa, we had a Super Bowl, and Eddie Mangan and I were sitting there and watching the rehearsal. They didn't ever told us, and they shot 4 big fireworks out on the ground, and they burned 4 places 30 feet by 30 feet.
Oh, jeez.
But we had a good crew, 3 people. We still have them from Arizona State. And we took some green paint and some yellow paint and dye, and we mixed it, and we were able to mask that field so you didn't notice it from 3 ways. If you looked at it, you never noticed it. But if you looked at it from another way, you knew there was something wrong. So you can't win them all.
So it started out with just you going down. And then did you say you took some people from your crew in Kansas City for a while then? Is that correct?
Right. The first time I just took one man with me.
Yeah.
And it started getting bigger and then bigger. And then I would take the Kansas City Chiefs crew and the athletics crew at that time. Or then it became Royals, where I'd have maybe about a dozen people. And then it got bigger as it went on. And because of practice fields, sometimes I would have to go in 6 weeks. And sometimes it would be 6 months because the practice field and the game field has to be exactly the same.
Yeah.
So we had in Jacksonville, we had to build 4 fields. We built 2 fields at North Florida University and then 2 fields at Bartram High School. And because they have to be the same as the game field, even if it's artificial, the league will change the artificial turf so both the practice fields and the game field is the same turf.
Exactly the
same. A lot of times it's beneficial to a college and a high school because the NFL will pay for that.
Sure.
Put the field in for them. And the thing is that it's a lot of money. But the teams maybe practice only 6 hours that week.
Wow.
That's it. You know what I mean? But the high schools and the colleges get the benefit of a new field, you know, artificial or even natural.
Now, in the early days, you obviously didn't have 6 months. You probably went down a week or so ahead of time, maybe at best.
Yeah, been a week or two because later on there was like 2 weeks before games.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times we would, the game being, you know, last part of January or first part of February, and we would go in sometimes 2 months ahead of time to oversee the practice fields. And the game feel. And a lot of times, you know, in those days, we didn't have sod. You know,
right.
We had a little sod, so we pre-germinated seed and seeded these fields. And I could say this, some of the fields that we overseeded were better than sod fields today.
I can believe that.
We, you know, used the field there for the footing. I remember San Diego, and Brian Bozzer was the groundkeeper there at that time. There was nothing left on the field. It was just all dirt. So you have to come up with ideas, and we couldn't verticut because we loosened it up too much.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a Bermuda Stolen pusher, a straight disc.
Sure.
When they, you know, put the Bermuda Stole on, push it in. So I had our crew, and we put some extra sandbags on that Stolen pusher, and all it did was make a crease in the ground. And so we took it one way and pre-germinated, and took it another. We took it four ways, pre-germinated it, and then on Friday, we top dressed it, put some Sadoo down, watered it good in. Then we covered it up with 6 mil plastic. We took 40 by 100 feet 6 mil plastic, and we glued them together to make a 200 by 400. Then we took a pin spiker, and we ran the pin spiker over after we covered the field. So we covered it on a Friday night. And then Monday, that grass was 2 inches high.
That's wow. Brilliant.
But that was not George Tolman. That was Dr. James R. Watson's idea.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, we had Dr. James R. Watson with us at every Super Bowl. You know, he'd come in, check our grass, check our sod, you know, and give us ideas. So, but we seeded all the Super Bowl fields. From Super Bowl one, we didn't seed anything because it was only a week before between games.
Mm-hmm.
But we seeded the fields for 29 Super Bowls.
Hmm.
I mean, say 28 Super Bowls. And for Super Bowl 29, we started a sod the field with big roll sod.
Mm-hmm.
And we brought the sod. The game was in Miami, and there wasn't much good sod around at that time. So we brought the sod in from Palm Desert, California, from West Coast Turf, and brought it in. And we sodded. That was the first field we sodded. Then the second one was West Coast Turf again in Arizona at Sun Devil Stadium.
Yeah, that was in 95.
Right, and
this when you first started. Yeah.
Now we have, you know, sod grown on plastic, which helps a lot. But you know, as I know, we watch football on TV, and a lot of fields are sodded, but they still are ripping up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's toupees coming up, and sod's ripping up, and we need to get good sod. The best sod we ever had was from Southern Turf Nurseries for the Super Bowl game between the Bears and the Colts. The whole game was played in the rain, and it was magnificent. It was the best. And then That was from Eddie Warner's turf farm. And then we soldered right on the concrete floor for an experiment between the Packers and the Saints in the Superdome. And we used Pop's Pollen, and that was the greatest looking, the two best sods I ever seen. Mm. But Eddie Warner grew it on plastic, and the rolls for sodding the Super Dome were 7 feet wide and 41 feet long. He could have cut it 10 feet wide, but he made a machine to lay it 7 feet wide. Because it's 7 feet wide, then this way it could fit on a truck.
Yeah, yeah.
If it was wider, they'd be hanging over. And then a lot of times you have to ship the sod by refrigerated trucks. But there's a lot of good sod farms out there now. And the Kansas City Chiefs here, they've been on the tops. They've been on the bottom six for years. For the worst field in the league. For years they had the worst field. And even Sports Illustrated, you know, said they have the worst field in the league. And they had some college games, and the coaches were saying they didn't want to play there unless they put artificial turf in. But I'm happy for the crew. They have Doug Schallenberger, a new groundkeeper there now. And he has the best playing field in the league this year. They went from the worst to the best. And I think the next best in the league is in San Francisco now. They had all those problems, soldered around 11 times over the years. Because when they built it, they put coarse sand in rather than medium sand. Mm-hmm. And the field just gave away with that coarse sand. But West Coast Turf now sells grass on plastic. And I seen the game Sunday on TV, and it was really magnificent. And I say the best sod grown on plastic right now is Carolina Green.
Hmm. Huh. Yeah,
like this is the first year for West Coast Turf to have plastic sod, and it's to me it looks outstanding. It could maybe match Eddie Warner's sod, but Eddie Warner's out of business now. But I think the groundkeepers have to have a good relationship between the sod growers and the groundkeeper. You get good sod, but you can see fields being sod and they still tear up. I think we still have to have, you know, good sod, you know, and have good sod grower groundkeeper relationship.
Right. Well, let me ask you, is there a certain Super Bowl that sticks out that they were just, you know, you ended up having a lot of issues, a lot of problems, or whether it's you know, getting stuff in there on time, or the, you know, the show they were putting on was just a little too chaotic or too big that it was really causing you guys problems, or you know, things like that. Is there one particular Super Bowl that sticks out in mind as just one that was a real bear to get through?
Well, one was a tough one. You know, we always says, you know, you can't assume things.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you, or you know what I mean, and out of me, you know, what assume is.
So I've heard that a few times.
Right. Assume, you know, I mean, you see it. Well, we had a Super Bowl in Miami, and it was the Pat system. And the roots at that field, we didn't saw it at those days, you know, and the root system was just about nil.
Hmm.
I remember Mr. Mascaro, you met him,
mm-hmm.
and he was consulting on that field, and they just didn't have, it was tough. There was no roots there, maybe only about an inch and a half down. So overseeded and things like that, and then we soldered the center of the field, the logo only, on the 50-yard line. And I was up in Chicago at that time working the playoff games, and our crew was back. And we couldn't, with the PAT system and the ownership of the stadium, said that we couldn't sod with clay-based sod, you know what I mean? That we had to use the sandy sod. But that's forgotten now. So everything went good, and then the team practiced. It was Cincinnati and San Francisco game, and the team practiced, and Paul Brown was with Cincinnati at that. He just loved the field. And same thing with Bill Walsh. You know, everything went good. So it started to rain, and on a Saturday afternoon, and Gary Morris was the groundkeeper at that time for the Dolphins. And he said, George, it's raining. He said, the rain's hard. That water comes down on the stands, and it comes up to the field. He says, we have to turn on the pumps for the patch systems to pump that, help pump that water out. So I said, go ahead, turn them on. So we covered the field. We covered it tight. It's raining, and we covered it tight. And then I says to one of our men, Andre and Gary Morris, I says, now, you two people go and shut those pumps off. We got the field covered. And I told one of our boys, Scotty, I said, you and I will walk this field and make sure that the canvas is nailed good down, so we don't want to come out at midnight that the canvas blew out. So we had everything thought. We had everything set. So it's raining the next morning, and about 1 o'clock we're taking the canvas off, and I told our boy Scotty, to be still with the Chiefs, good groundkeeper, to go and start mowing the grass. We'll take the canvas off, you start mowing. And he came over to me, he said, there's this bad noise. This noise don't sound good. I said, well, just pull the grass cutter aside and see what's the matter with it. He said, no, it's a noise. It's a funny noise. It's on the field. Here's what happened. Gary and Andre forgot to turn the pumps off.
Oh, boy.
And with that canvas on there, it just sucked all that moisture out of there.
Yeah, sure.
And I mean, sucked all that moisture out of there. About 3 or 4 plays, the NFL logo wasn't there. Yeah, I mean, it just, you know, with no root system and that not set play, you know. So that was a big one. So you can't assume things, you know. You have to go and you got to delegate authority, you know. But something like that big game. So after that, I said to myself, nothing will ever again deface the NFL logo. I said, even when I die, I want the NFL logo on me. So that was it. So, but we had a game in Tampa during Desert Storm. And we had the game in Tampa, and then they had a change the halftime show to be patriotic, because Desert Storm, they put, you know, metal detectors into people. They had machine guns up on the press box, you know, things like that. And so they practiced, and they wore out the logo on the 50-yard line. And I said, we got to resaw this. And the Giants were working out, and Tom Coughlin, the coach for the Giants, says, well, George, I think you've got to resaw it. We became good buddies, Tom and Coughlin and I. So where are you going to get sawed at 6 o'clock at night? You know what I mean? And I said, I know a place we'll get sawed. So I told Ed Mangan, you know, Eddie now runs the show, you know, at the NFL. And I told Ed Mangan, you go and take 1,000 square feet out of that center of the field at 6 o'clock at night. Go down about 4 inches. And I says, I'm going to go get sod. So he had a crew that they went down 4 inches. And then I went over to University of Tampa. And it was, by that time, it was about 8 o'clock at night. And Kevin, who was still the ground, who still works for Tampa Bay Buccaneers, I rode over with his truck, and I told our crew to bring their cars with them. So we went over to Tampa Bay, the university there. They had a beautiful soccer field, and it was dark at night, and the gate was locked. And I see, I know the gate's locked, Kevin. I know. I said, just get the truck and ram the damn thing and push it in. So we broke the gate and we went in and we stole actually 1,000 square feet of sod along the fence.
Oh, at least you stayed around the fence.
He was a friend of mine, you know. So when I got back, I said, you can put me in jail. But they were very well compensated for that 1,000 square feet we sold along the fence, you know. But we put it in, and by 2 o'clock in the morning, at the 3 o'clock, we had the logo painted again, and it held up great, you know. But this way, if we didn't, it would be just like Miami. The logo would have been gone. The groundkeeper is a good friend of mine, you know, and he wasn't there, but... they were very well compensated, you know.
I'm sure the NFL aren't sure of that.
It saved the game, you know. This way, you put it on, there'll be no logo left.
That's right.
So that was the one in Miami was a tough one, you know. And then Cincinnati and the 49ers, and then we had the one with the Giants and the Bills with the stolen 50-yard line, and it played great.
So out of all those games, what is your most memorable game that you loved, whether it was because of the field you did or maybe it was the actual game itself that you loved, or maybe just everything went so smoothly and so perfectly that you were so darn proud? You know, is it, I'm sure there's some of those that stick out in your mind.
Yeah, well, there's games, you know, like at the Rose Bowl, we never re-soldered. And we would seed, you know, and it came back. And then I remember the Giants were out there playing. And then after the game, Bill Parcells made a special trip to come over to see me and thank me how beautiful and outstanding the field played.
Mm.
And the Rose Bowl's another little tough place, beautiful fields, you know, and good groundkeepers. And we were out there 1 year for Super Bowl, and it's the Rose Bowl 45 feet below the top of the field. I mean, the top of the entrance. And up at top of the entrance, the roses are nice and blooming, and the Bermuda's nice and green. But down on the field, it's cold. And you see the ryegrass, overseed everything with ryegrass.
Mm-hmm.
And then Gus, the groundkeeper, would shut the gates, the two gates leading on the field, so nobody would walk on it. So when you walk on it, the grass will turn black, you know, breaking with the frost.
Mm-hmm.
So after the frost got out, Gus and I walked on the field, and we seen a few footprints. And then we seen a little crease in the grass going to the stands, and well, something happened here, you know what I mean? And here Caltech got in there and put a bomb in there, not a really bomb, but a bomb that it's a fireworks bomb that goes up.
Oh, yeah.
And the parachute comes down. And they had like Caltech, you know, 100 and Massachusetts Institute of Technology 0, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And one time they got into the scoreboard with profanity, and they couldn't use the scoreboard the whole game. And then one time I was on the field and working on the field, and I heard four boom, 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 boom. Here there was a kid in the parking lot flying a radio-controlled airplane. And here, them Caltech guys had those things in the goalposts. So they had the same frequency as they had, and with the little boy with the plane frequency, shot them off Saturday before the game. But you have to watch them like that. But, you know, it's things like that, you know, happen. And then we have... games, you know, where they're being played well, like we in San Diego, we had the Green Bay Packers and the Denver Broncos, and I could still close my eyes standing in the end zone and seeing John Elway running for the first down. He's going to either make it or he's going to get killed. He made it, and they went on to beat the Packers. That was that little extra, the end and some.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit, you know, you obviously have transitioned out of the leadership of that, I believe. You said Ed, right. Eddie's hanging that. Tell us a little bit about how that came about. What was it that, what was the turning point for you that you decided, you know, I'm ready to let somebody else be the head guy running this and I'll just kind of be the support? You know, how did that come about?
Well, actually, for a while, we had my son, Chip, and he's retired now. And then I got Eddie the job with the Atlanta Braves. He was working for Boardwalk and Baseball down in Haines City, Florida, where we had the Royals train. There was a big amusement park. We had baseball there from 8 in the morning to midnight. And he was a pretty good groundkeeper. And so I consulted for Sam Kasten and John Miller, and then they needed a groundkeeper. They just asked me to come down and look at their field. So I went down there and looked at the field, and it was bad. You know, it was infield was almost all algae in the outfield, and the grass was bad. So I told Sam Kasten, two things you can do. Either the groundkeeper you have now has to turn it around and do the job, and I says, or you're going to have to get a new groundkeeper. I said, you're going to have to think it over. I said, we can maybe come down and help this groundkeeper turn it around, or you have to get a new groundkeeper. So they called me in a week. They said, can you find us a new groundkeeper? And I said, I have a man for you, Eddie Mangan. And then we got Eddie Mangan the job with the Braves. And then when then I start taking them to the Super Bowls. Then when I go overseas, I would take Eddie with me to Germany, Spain, you know, or we'd go. And he was a good worker. And then when it come time to change, and then I says, you know, we're got to start breaking somebody else in. And then like 3 years ago, I had open heart surgery, had an aorta valve replaced, was supposed to be in the hospital for 5 days. Here I have so many complications, I was in for 7 weeks.
Wow.
I went through, that was in August. I went through rehab, and I went even to freeze my fanny out at the Giants game, where it was really cold. But it wasn't too bad because we had to put up tents to do the end zone. The tents were like 35 feet wide and 200 feet long, you know, and they were heated. So in the same on the 50-yard line, but it snowed and snowed. And our crew and the Giants crew did an outstanding job. I'm so proud of the Giants crew, what a job they did. And that's the way it goes now. So we work together on it, and we still have mostly the same crew. And we have three people from Japan that come in that work our fields in Japan, and they have excellent work ethics, great people. And we split up into crews, and people do their job. And
it's a lot of
long hours because of, you know, the rehearsals that take so much time. After rehearsals, you got to fix their damage and get it going. So we'll just see what happens.
And that crew is kind of an all-star crew in and of itself, isn't it? You have quite a few people from various facilities around the country, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, right. We have Arizona State. We have two boys from there. They've been on the crew for years. Excellent people, and from other ball clubs, baseball clubs, you know, and Andy Levy from the Arizona Cardinals, and a couple people from the Chargers, and a couple people from the Padres. We have a good crew. Then we have our good girl Heather from the Detroit Tigers.
Yeah.
She even goes to London after the season to do a game or two in London.
So obviously this whole Super Bowl thing grew into much more with the NFL with you, where you were also doing things like, I think you'd also used to do the Pro Bowl, correct?
Right. I did 26 Pro Bowls.
Sure.
And then the Pro Bowls, you know, start being a week apart, you know what I mean?
So mm-hmm.
A week before the game, so, you know, we couldn't do it. Though we had the Pro Bowl last year in Arizona. Sunday before the game, you know, so, but the Pro Bowl's in Hawaii, and it was at Aloha Stadium there, and the ground crew at Aloha Stadium, is, I would have to say, it's artificial turf, but they're so immaculate. It's the best crew that I ever worked with, and most of the people are in their 80s. You know, they have a couple young guys, Louie and Fraulein, they're younger, in their 40s. And they're so immaculate, you know what I mean? Everything is perfect, you know. But they're older people, and they do a heck of a good job. And after the game, you'd have to stay about a week, you know, to go ahead and wash the logos off the field.
Mm-hmm.
So usually now I don't do that, so I just do the Super Bowl, and then I'd come home for about 2 days. Then for the last 16 years, I've been doing Minnesota twin spring training at Fort Myers, Florida for the Twins for the last 16 years. Lord be willing, this will be my 17th year with the Twins for 8 weeks.
No plans to slow down, I take it.
No, when the Lord says that's it, you know, that's it.
Yeah.
But I can't sit still, you know what I mean?
Yeah. As you know, as long as you're having fun at it, that's really all that counts, George, because I've always said that groundskeeping, to me, is a job that keeps you young.
Right. I mean, I've been doing it now for 73 years, so, I enjoyed the Royals being in the postseason and winning the World Series, so I spent the month of October with Trevor. And he does an excellent job. He has a good playing field, good infield there, great mound and everything. And then I'm so happy for the Chiefs being in the worst 10 for 10, 15 years. You know, I'm at the bottom there, the worst 6, and coming through this year. Had 2 games in the rain already, 2 Sundays. A week ago Sunday, they had 2 inches of rain during the game, and I went over there Tuesday and looked at the field, and you didn't think anybody played on it. You get good sod. That was Northridge Bermuda from Carolina Green. And this is the first year that since the Chiefs had grass that they don't have to resod during the season.
Oh, that's cool.
I mean, it's great. You know, I mean, it's great. Now, Sunday could be the third day, Sunday in a row, that's going to rain because they're forecasting 90% rain with maybe a little sleet and snow. So I hope it doesn't for the crew because they have another game left on January the 3rd and they'll be in the playoffs. But it's just good to see the boys go, you know, getting ripped in the papers, you know, to having a great, outstanding field. I believe the Chiefs and the San Francisco 49ers has the best playing fields in the league. And it's easier than you and I had it, Paul, because we had a seed sod. Now some of these teams sod 5 times or using 500,000 square feet of sod a year. You know what I mean? In our days, we had to fight it. You know what I mean? Seed it. But now, you know what I mean? The field goes bad, a company comes in and takes it out, lays it, and then you just line it up again. Then it goes bad, and you do the same thing, you know, for 2, 3. Some do it 5 times, you know what I mean?
And, you know, and that's the other change.
It's a different
story. Yeah, that's the other change in the industry too, George, is that you see more and more groundskeepers just bringing in contractors to do that main work when back in the old days we did all ourselves, you know?
That's it. You'd have
we would strip it. We would grade it. We would, you know, we would do all of that ourselves.
Right, we have to take it, we have to lay it with our crew and do everything, you know. But when we do the Super Bowl, we have our crew right there,
yeah.
You know I mean, to help, you know what I mean? We put it in, you know. And it's I don't say it's harder, but maybe it's easier, you know, because this way you have resod it and you have a good field. But again, if you have bad sod, you know, sometimes they'll sod a field which they shouldn't sod a field because the sod they brought in is worse than the sod that was on the field.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
You know, I mean, well, sometimes people don't want to hear me say things like that.
Well, and you know what else is interesting is you know, I think back of my in my childhood back in the 60s of growing up watching football and baseball. And of course back then you had shared stadiums. You know, it wasn't a big deal if your field didn't look absolutely perfect. You know, it was accepted to have wear on your field when you played. Now, you better not have a blemish on that field. You know, every right. field has yeah. to be absolutely perfect. We've almost cornered ourselves into right. you can't fail anymore, or you can't right. have one little blemish.
No, you got to work at it. Just like my theory is, that as groundkeepers, we have to give the players the best possible, best condition, and give them a safe playing field.
Yeah.
Make it safe for these players. Then number two, like you say, for the fans in the stands and the fans on TV, we got to give them a field of beauty.
Yes.
And number three, we got to try to do it without taking too much money out of the owner's coffers. But in our days, you know, we didn't have that money. And then, two, you know what I mean? It's good the way they do it now is that they're giving the players a good playing field. And
yeah.
But still, at times, you look on TV and the fields are ripping up, you know, just resodded. But they have to have a better groundkeeper sod relationship. But
yeah.
like I say, people don't want to hear me say it, but a lot of times corruption comes in and they're not getting the best sod that yeah. they possibly can.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, again, you know, we talk about the past where you had stadiums that were shared fields, both baseball and football. And in the late 70s and into the 80s and 90s, we got away from that and we got football only and baseball only stadiums. And we had a period of time there where both sports had their great time of, you know, one not influencing the other and not affecting each other's playing surface. Now what you're starting to see is things like that happen again, but it's soccer and football or soccer and baseball.
Right.
And you're going to start seeing, I predict you're going to start seeing some problems with fields because they're trying to, again, once again, overschedule those fields again. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
But you take like Kansas City, we had it a little easier than you. We had it easier than Milwaukee and Minnesota because you're in the cold area.
Yeah.
You know, in Detroit too. But, you know, a lot of these clubs, the football clubs and baseball clubs, didn't get along. And the only one I really seen that would get along was the Detroit Tigers and the Detroit Lions when they had baseball and football in the same stadiums. Mm. And you had to suffer up there, you know, the cold weather, and you had to be ready for opening day. And
yeah.
Dick Erickson the same way. But in Kansas City, we had football, soccer, and baseball. And then we also had the Beatles concert. But with baseball, football, and soccer, we never resodded. Everything was done with seed.
Hmm.
And then they said, you know, we had a good baseball field, good football field, and a good soccer field. But we would grow Heinz 77 seed mix in, you know, with bluegrass and rye, and in our days we only had bluegrass and ryegrass. We don't have all those good festivals
yeah.
now and things like that. And
sure.
then around Memorial Day, we start working in Bermuda grass, Bermuda seed. I remember Bermuda seed being 35 cents a pound in my days. And then by 4th of July, our field was all Bermuda. And then in September, we start throwing in the ryegrass. And then we never resodded the infield dirt, you know, for the games. A lot of people played all year on the dirt.
Yeah, yep.
And I would pre-germinate grass seed, and after the last game, we'd take the pitcher mound down and scarify the infield with a big nail drag in the baselines, and then throw on pre-germinated seed on Sunday night after the game. On Tuesday, on Friday, we'd be mowing it, and on Saturday, we'd be painting it. And if it got a little cold, Doc Watson would have us put on 6-mil plastic over the dirt. But we had grass on the infield dirt all year, you know, from the first game to the last game. You couldn't even, no difference, because what happened there, we had the footing from the dirt, and the grass gave us the aesthetics of the field, and it worked out great.
Well, this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Super Bowl, and you told me, I think it was a month or two ago, that this is a pretty special one, because it's not only is it the 50th anniversary of the Super Bowl, but you are one of the very few people who have worked every single Super Bowl. You and, I forget, was it 7 or 8 other people?
There's 12. There's
12, I'm sorry.
4 photographers or 5, and then some press, and I believe there's a fan, and there's Lamar Hunt's wife, Norma, and myself. It will be the 12th. 12 people, you know, that they'll honor somehow, some way, you know, out at San Francisco.
It's pretty amazing that there's that few people who have been through all 50 of those Super Bowls. You know, you've gotten to see some pretty amazing stuff over the course of those 50 years, and it, you know, talk about a lifetime of memories of things where you've, I mean, you know, the Super Bowl is one of the biggest events in the United States each year. And to be associated with that, you have to be awful proud. You have to be proud of your crews that have worked for you, proud of the suppliers that have helped you work the magic that you work on those fields. Certainly proud of your family for putting up with all your trouble, all your travel and crazy lifestyle to get all that in. It has to be a pretty amazing ride for you, and something that I'm sure you really cherish.
Well, it's things I really love. Like a lot of times I talk with my wife, I was never home for Christmas. You know, I'd either be at a playoff game or already working on the fields, you know, for the Super Bowl. But I always say there's no George Toma. There's no George Toma without the people that he works with. And nobody has ever worked for me. They all worked with me. And then also, it's a pleasure you go into some stadiums that, you know, they have an excellent ground crew, and you work together as a team. And then some stadiums, you know, it's tough. They have the I don't care attitude, you know. So it makes, but it has changed over the years. Then from the early days, because I don't know for how many years, 10 or 20 years now, that the NFL takes over the entire stadium. It's the NFL stadium, the parking lots, everything belongs to the NFL. So, you know, everything, ground crew, if you have a suite for all the games of the Super Bowl there, it's not your suite no more. The NFL takes over everything, you know.
Sure, sure.
For just a fast story one time, a good friend of mine, I won't say the stadium or his name, but people know all about it, you know. It's the NFL stadium, and I was working on a practice field, and I came back to the stadium a little earlier, and then Eddie Mangan was at another one, and he came back from the stadium, and then I came in ahead of him, and I'm come down to the stadium, and here the groundkeeper is spraying the field, and I says, "What the heck are you doing?" I said, "You know, this is in an NFL field, and we're going to spray tonight." He said, "Oh, I got to get my field for March ready." I said, "The heck with March. We got a game in 2 weeks." One of these here supply companies, a well-known chemical supply company, gave the groundkeeper 6 months' supply of products, fertilizers, things like that. And then the poor groundkeeper is a little young at that time, but he's an NFL groundkeeper today. And he put the whole 6 months in the tank.
Oh, my God.
And, and when he took off, you know, instead of turning on the tractor first and take off, then turn off the turn on the sprayer, where it hit there, it killed the grass all the way down to the dirt. And the whole field was dead the next day, 2 weeks before the game.
Oh, my gosh. I mean,
you know, we always kid him, yet, did you have enough room to put water in there? You know,
with there's no way he did.
Supply of fertilizers, you know, but he burnt the whole field. But, you know, I could have fired him, you know, but I always say sometimes give people a chance. That's why they put erasers on pencils.
Yeah.
And today we helped him out, and he's one of the top groundkeepers in the NFL.
Yeah, he was just young is all. That's all.
Right.
If I'd gotten fired for every mistake I made when I was young.
I'm right up there with you. Well, George, it's been a pleasure reminiscing with you about the past Super Bowls. I can find no better way to spend any hour of any day of any time of the year than talking to you. We've got so much knowledge, so many memories, so many great stories about the work you've done, the work people have worked with you, everything about it. I just, you're a walking history book of groundskeeping, and I just love talking to you, and I'm sure our listeners love listening to you. I really appreciate you being on the show, and congratulations on 50 years of working the Super Bowls, and good luck this coming Super Bowl in San Francisco.
What? Like this. Every Super Bowl I've had, or, you know, I'm in the NFL Hall of Fame, the groundkeeper, Major League Baseball Groundkeepers Hall of Fame, you know, the Kansas City Royals Hall of Fame, and Sports Science Hall of Fame. But let me tell you this, each and every one of you groundkeepers that I know, and some that I don't know, and I go way back with you and Harry Gill and Pat Sanderone, but all you people that I know and people that I know, you can bet your boots that your fingerprints are on this, on all these awards, and your fingerprints are also on the Super Bowl award, because we're all one big family. A lot of times we disagree or don't disagree, but we just have to give the players the best possible safe playing field, and then, you know, a field of beauty for the fans in the stands. And look at the field of beauty you used to give with your beautiful patterns in your field.
But you bet.
Thank you, Paul, and to each and every one of you and all the groundkeepers in the world, I would like to say Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, and may all your good fortunes be as numerous as blades of grass and seed, the gift of life. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, George. At Beacon Athletics, we've been helping America maintain and improve its ball field since 1948. We're innovators. We're out on our test fields every day developing products that simply do the job better, like the Streamliner Chalker and the Sweet Spot Tamp System. Everything we do for the love of the game. We're so confident in our commitment to the industry that we at Beacon have a promise. We'll provide great products and great service, so there is no risk for you. When you place an order with us, we know you need your stuff, so we promise to ship all in-stock items in 24 hours. If you're not happy, neither are we. We guarantee your satisfaction, period. We'll refund your purchase price and pay for the return shipping. If you have questions, we have answers. We actually use all of our products, so we know all the ins and outs. We are Beacon Athletics, and that's our promise to you. Well, again, another great interview by George Toma. He gave us some really great stuff on baseball during the summer, and now just a really cool look into what's been going on with him in the NFL over the past 50 years, and working for working for them on their Super Bowls and Pro Bowls and things like that. So with that, I would say that this pretty much puts this show in the books, Teresa.
And don't miss a minute of our next show. There are lots of places where you can find our podcast on the web. There's, of course, our main page at beaconathletics.com/podcast. But you can also download our show through Apple iTunes. If you do, we'd love it if you'd leave a review for us. There are also a bunch of different podcast apps, whatever works best for you, obviously. And now you can go to baseballtalkradio.com or baseballpodcast.net. Both of those places have us, and along with a lot of other baseball podcasts. We've been listening to a couple of them. We really like them. They've got some great shows out there. We'd like you to take a listen and see if there's something else you like besides us.
Yes. Hey, but we do love it that you like listening to us, I hope.
Oh, well, of course.
And we'd love to hear from you. So if you get a chance, you can email Teresa and I at podcast@beaconathletics.com, or you can send us your questions or comment on our show, good or bad. Or if you got some great show ideas, you can send them send those along as well.
Easy for you to say, Paul. And guys, we're working on our show ideas for the next season. So this is a great time to send us some ideas. Otherwise, you're stuck with what we pick.
That's right.
And if by chance you're a Twitter follower, our Twitter handle is @DiamondDaVincis. That's @DiamondDaVincis. Not crazy active there, but we like to share things now and again, so check us out.
The Diamond Da Vincis podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 68 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. And with that, I bid you adios.
You stole my line. Adieu.